In this episode, we uncover the legal twists and turns of international adoption, dual citizenship, and how immigration law can impact your family.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we had Maria Aguila on the show, and we had a great conversation about the legal process and challenges of international adoption and key protections and considerations for individuals with dual citizenship. I hope this episode is valuable to anyone who might be listening. Stay tuned for the full episode. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. Today, Maria Aguila is joining us. Maria is an immigration attorney here in Jacksonville, Florida, and has represented clients from the Philippines, Poland, India, Colombia, and many more countries. Today, Maria and I will be discussing how the immigration and family law intersect and impact families, the legal process and challenges of international adoption, and key protections and considerations for individuals with dual citizenship. Welcome, Maria.
Hello, Heather. It's so nice to see you, and thank you for having me on this podcast.
Well, I am so happy to have you. I think these issues are very interesting to me and hopefully to our listeners because, you know, immigration is certainly in the news a lot and it really does affect so many people. And, you know, when we look at family law, you know, I think it's good to have a discussion as to these intersections. But for our listeners who may or may not have heard you on the show before, would you share a little bit about yourself and really how you got into this area of practice that you're in today?
Yes, I've been an attorney now 24 years. I do have my practice in Jacksonville, Florida. So I have new satellite office for my immigration practice in Orlando and Tampa. And I do practice family law as well and international adoptions. I got into this, my family is from the Philippines. They immigrated here as medical visa working for a hospital, and they became permanent residents and naturalized citizens. I remember being at my parents' naturalization ceremony, waving the American flag in the ceremony. I didn't realize how important that day was. I was only, I think, 4 years old. But I remember that day, and it kind of stuck with me and the journey my family had to raise my sister and I born here. And we were born in the United States, and they've saved a lot of lives as being in the medical profession.
That is a great story. And it is, you know, it's a wonderful thing, I think, for people who, you know, come over and then they're able to become citizens, which is a great day and really worth celebrating for sure. Now, let's talk about, because I've known a few people who have adopted children from another country, but didn't know, you know, about the intricacies of the process. So I think that is a good place to start as far as helping me and our listeners understand what are the legal steps involved in adopting a child from another country.
Right. So there's basically two main things to understand about adopting a child internationally. It depends on where that child is from, what the child's home country is, because depending on the country of that child will dictate whether it's a Hague Convention or a non-Hague adoption. And so the steps are different. When it's a Hague Convention, which is basically a treaty and agreement that the United States has with certain countries to ensure that children aren't being kidnapped and taken for trafficking and adoption purposes. So this is a way to monitor and take that country can be mindful and take care of those children who are possibly in that international adoption process so that they don't end up being just easily trafficked and taken outside their own country. So there's a lot of steps involved. It's very a complex situation when you are adopting an international child because not only are you worrying about United States federal immigration laws, you also have to be mindful of that country, of that child's laws on adoption, as well as the immigration side, the state side of where the child or children is going to end up residing with the adoptive parent. So we have our own laws in Florida. And so that's why for any parent seeking to adopt the child and taking them to the United States is not simple or easy in any way. I would say it's probably one of the most complicated family-based type of cases. And a lot of U.S. citizen adoptive parents make the mistake and think, well, I adopted the child. I should just be able to bring the child. It's a child be U.S. citizen. No, they're not at all, actually. They have to go through a process.
So there's, because the adoption in and of itself is can be extremely complicated and especially because you're dealing with another country. But there, I think, right, there's two legal processes. There is the adoption, but then there's also the immigration, because once you go through the first part, well, should you even go? How do you do it? What order? I guess you've got to do it simultaneously. Is it difficult to get your adopted child as, I guess, what is the status, right? They would have to then eventually go through a naturalization ceremony at some point, or by adopting them, does that create their citizenship at some point?
Okay, so it really depends on the process of which that child is going to be adopted through.
Okay.
So, convention, for instance, when you have to go through this entire process, because when it's a Hague Convention adoption, first, typically you have to file your form, the I-800A, to be established as suitable and eligible to adopt. You have to be a United States citizen. You have to be habitually resident in the United States. And if you're not married, you have to be at least 24 years old, and be 25 years old when you file what we call the I-800. And the child, in order to be classified as a Hague Convention adoptee, have to be under the age of 16 at the time of the filing of the I-800, be habitually resident in the actual Hague country, and then be deemed eligible for the intercountry adoption by, and every Hague Convention country has what they call a central authority of adoption. They're the ones who consent to even allow this child to be adopted to a United States adoptive parent or parent. And so it starts with choosing an accredited adoption service provider, or it can be an immigration attorney. You have to get a home study done for an intercountry adoption home study. And there are only certain agencies that can do that. And so you have to find out who they are. Then you file the I-800A. And if you're deemed to be suitable and eligible to adopt a child, that primary provider can apply to, or the immigration attorney can help you find placement, with the central authority. And then it goes from there. And then before adopting the child, then you do the I-800 petition. Once that gets approved, it's provisionally approved by USCIS. Then, if you are an adoptive parent living in the United States, that child has to get an immigrant visa. And that immigrant visa, that child enters the United States and gets a green, is now that green card holder and is a here in the United States legally. But it's such a process. And unfortunately, I think this is going to become much more difficult to obtain. There are a lot of concerns about human trafficking, but also I think there's kind of concerns about bringing children. I think, especially if they're maybe a little older, almost teens. I think if they're male, I think it also may depend on the country they're coming from. And some countries have said we're no longer allowing children to be adopted from our country internationally at all. So,
Really?
yeah, say that. But that's the Hague Convention process, and the non-Hague goes through a different process called the I-600 process. And so it's a bit similar, except you don't have Hague, you don't have a central authority you have to deal with. And so you're just basically dealing with the country and their particular adoption or orphanage. Yeah. And so it's, yeah. And then ultimately, the child, if they do enter on the immigrant visa, they ultimately then can derive the U.S. citizenship, and they have to file what we call for a certificate of citizenship, the N-600. And that's kind of like almost like a final step. And some people take it further. And then in the state of Florida, they register the foreign birth certificate, to kind of finalize everything in the state of Florida. And have that registration done here.
And so eventually, yes, they can become a citizen because they were adopted.
Yes, if everything is done to the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the big if.
That they would be able to derive their U.S. citizenship from the adoptive parent and ultimately file for their proof of citizenship. Because it's not like they wouldn't be able to produce a birth certificate and say, oh, I'm a U.S. citizen. No, you got your green card and your citizenship through adoption.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. And I can see why there might be scrutiny if we're not talking about young children and, you know, the intent of the adoption. But I think it's just in general, it's becoming harder, right, to immigrate into the country, even through these means.
Think it's and once you have the first things first is when it comes to international adoption is like, okay, who are the adoptive parent or parents? And then where are you wanting to adopt from? Is it an child you already know? Sometimes it's a relative's child, aunt, okay, uncle, sister, brother's child, or sometimes it is just a child, or maybe there's no child identified, saying we're not unable to have children, but I really would love to adopt a child from wherever. And so mm-hmm. it really just depends where you have to get all those details. Then you devise, okay, so this child is from this, or okay, what country? And then you determine what, is it Hague? Is it non-Hague? Or is this child already adopted before you talk to an immigration attorney? And now there's this way of applying for the child, but that's if you have 2 years legal physical and adoption and custody of the child. The child has been residing in your care for at least those 2 years. And then you have to determine whether or not what happened with the parent. Sometimes people say, well, I adopted my niece or nephew so they could stay in the United States. Well, that's not really an adoption.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really adopt just to help that person get that green card. So if someone would just, well, they're from a country and it's hard, they can't support their child financially, that's not a good enough reason to apply for a green card for the child based on adoption. If the parents were deceased or one parent is incapacitated and the other has abandoned the child, then maybe then you've got that evidence to prove that this is not your standard case of, well, they just released a child for adoption just so the child can get a green card.
Understand. Right. And I guess that step is somewhat taken care of if the child has been abandoned or is in an orphanage, right? I mean, that's kind of, the orphanage is now their custodian, I suppose, guardian, right? So.
And then it's a matter of, well, how good is his adoption orphanage? Were they good at keeping records of these children or were these children taken? And so you have to be concerned. Certain countries, when the orphanage or the adoption service provider in that country can't produce documentation of how this child got to be in their care, that could be a problem. Because technically, yes, this child could be an orphan. Or they say this child is an orphan, but we're really not sure who the parents are. And how did this child get to be in their care?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is of concern. A lot of Ukrainian young children were taken by the Russians and their whereabouts are unknown. They may have been adopted out somewhere else or by another family in Russia. They don't know. They never kept records, you know, of these poor children. And so I throw that out as an example because I think that came out recently in the news. And I think, goodness, can you imagine the parents of these poor children? They have no clue where their child is. No clue.
Yeah, that I know. There's just there's a whole nother thing, right? Oh my gosh. But let's talk a little bit about, I've heard this term a lot, like dual citizenship, right? So in my understanding, like, and just as probably more green than our listeners, right? Like, because, you know, there's so many things that I don't know. But if as a U.S. citizen, I have a child, that makes them a U.S. citizen, I'm guessing. And then I think, and let's say their father is a German citizen, they would automatically receive dual citizenship. Is that true?
Okay, well, I don't know about German immigration laws or citizenship laws of other countries per se.
Okay.
Depending on the country, so sometimes individuals who are not U.S. citizens and the child is born and you're a U.S. citizen. The child is born on U.S. soil, so that child is a U.S. citizen. But if the other parent is foreign born and still maintains the citizenship of their particular home country, check with the laws in that country.
Because they may be able to petition for them to have
citizenship.
Because
maybe that child would derive that German citizenship from the other biological parent who is the father in the scenario you bring up.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes some children do have dual citizenship. Well, my mom is this, or, you know, my parents are, were living in this country and where they're from, but they're also, they're a dual citizen of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And they could derive, that child could derive citizenship from that country as well. I've had that happen where a child had two or three passports, and I was like, oh, how'd this happen? And they tell me the whole background, and I was like, well, gosh, that leaves a lot of flexibility of where you want to go, which I guess could be really nice. And, so yeah, it's always important to check with the laws of that particular country. And some laws, they change it where they leave it open. For instance, my parents were born in the Philippines, but they're naturalized U.S. citizens. Well, under Philippine law, I could derive my Philippine citizenship through my parents.
Okay.
Provided I file the right paperwork with evidence of the whole relationship and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I could technically be both a Philippine citizen and a United States citizen since I was born in the United States. So that kind of can cut a lot of red tape where I could be, live in the Philippines part of the time if I wanted to without
right.
any red tape, no visa required. I could get a Philippine passport, but then I could be a U.S. citizen, you know, coming back, you know, I would.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you and I are U.S. citizens, let's say had a child, but the child was born in another country, but we fully intended and we did come back to the U.S. Does that affect your child's citizenship if they're actually born in a different country and not like on a military base or not through that? I don't know if that's different or not, but, you know, just you were traveling, which you just decided then to have your baby in another country.
Yes.
Does that affect your U.S. citizenship?
Well, if a child is born overseas but to U.S. parent or parents, the step would be to register the child's birth abroad at the U.S. consulate in that country. And that is what would need to be filed. Child registration of birth abroad, CRBA. And a lot of parents don't do that. They maybe don't realize to do it, or they just forgot about it. And they thought, well, I'll just apply for my child's U.S. passport. Well, you know, there's then steps you got to show then your citizenship, you know, and then you've got to go through. And then because the birth certificate is going to be foreign, right?
Right.
It's not going to be issued by the United States. So you have to make sure to go through the right paperwork to establish your child's U.S. citizenship. And it's depending on the birth and where and how old is the child, and whether did you take steps to do the registration abroad, or if you didn't, then we've got to go through the steps to ensure that this child can prove they are a U.S. citizen. And then there's whole derivation of paternity cases, and that gets very complicated as well. When it's a paternity, when the mother is not married to the father,
right?
And the father is, the mother's U.S. born, not U.S. born, it's foreign born, but the father is the United States.
So then how do you handle that?
Yeah, so our immigration laws say that there is all these steps to establish a paternity in order for that child to derive citizenship from the father. So there are all these, you have to prove obviously the child is a child of a U.S. citizen or parent. Then, you know, they have, so hopefully the father is on the birth certificate or has signed a paternity, or maybe they got a state court order saying that he is in fact the father, or even a child support case in the state of Florida where we have final judgments of paternity. The U.S. citizen parent, the father, has to prove certain residence and physical presence requirements in the United States, with the exception of military, and then any other requirement depending on how the child is going to derive citizenship.
So
they have these charts. You ever want to have fun with it at USCIS.gov? It has a chart, and you look at the chart. Okay, is it two parents or is it one parent? Were they born in wedlock or were they born married when the parents are married? Because paternity has all these legitimation requirements.
Right.
So they talk about, you know, paternity or acknowledgement in writing, DNA test results,
Okay.
also helpful in those paternity type cases.
Let's talk about, because you touched on it, like having a child support order, but can you establish child support? Because I'm wondering if this intersection between immigration or international situations and family law has happened for you. If you've had these cases where you establishing child support if the other parent is living outside the U.S.
Yeah, so you mean the paying parent?
Yeah, like let's say the paying parent lives outside the U.S. Well, for ease, the mom comes to you, the child, and it's like, this is where the dad is, but maybe he was paying child support, or he, even if he's not, or if he was ordered to, or I need child support and I don't know what to do. How can I make him pay? And he doesn't live in the US.
So what's really, really difficult with child support cases when the paying parent of the child support does not reside in the United States at all? Honestly,
Yeah.
enforcement. I mean, you can't have an income withholding order, an income deduction order of someone who's not working in the United States. But the jurisdiction just doesn't go that far. So you may get a paper child support judgment, but whether that mother will actually collect any child support payment becomes an issue. And sometimes we have fathers or paying parents, could be the mother too, where they establish a child support obligation and the person was here. But then I think of what
They
if that parent
leave.
gets deported? Or what if that parent just leaves the United States, says, well, I don't want to stay here, or, they try to escape their child support obligation and they're not a U.S. citizen, then they could definitely escape that obligation. And, we can't send local police over. Or,
Right.
you can't. So it really is horrible. And that has come up, and the concern of even in divorces, you
Right.
see where the parent who's majority taking care of the child or children and has a child support order in their hand, if the parent leaves and leaves the United States.
Yeah.
Now, if it's a U.S. citizen and they're in arrears, 2,500 or more, no passport for you. You're not leaving the United States.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing. That's an important thing to enforce
It is.
these orders and make sure, because then something with some teeth. Have you ever heard of, I know you have a lot of international colleagues, I'm certain, but like that where maybe someone was successful, because the only thing I would first tell them to talk to an immigration attorney, talk to you, but then I would also be thinking, well, should we be finding you an attorney in that country where they're residing? To see if you have any recourse under that country's laws.
International, yeah, that other country. Yes, and sometimes, yeah, you might be able to do that. And in fact, I was speaking to a lawyer in Spain, and they said in family law there, the subject was about child support and how long it can last. And in Florida, as you know, then when a child turns 18 or graduates, it ends, unless it's a special needs child or the parties agree to pay child support beyond that. Well, in Spain, you have to pay for that child until they graduate college. Like it goes beyond that age. And so what if it's a child and the child has dual citizenship in Spain and US and maybe Spanish? I'm just throwing, I don't know if this is true. Spanish law would apply. I'm just making up facts. I don't want readers or listeners to think I know all this. I'm just wondering then if that were the case, could then the parent who is supposed to pay the child support in Spain could get a separate court order? Let's say the child decides to go to college in Spain. Would Spain take jurisdiction of that case and say, well, this child is a Spanish citizen, and even though you divorced in the United States, you're subject to our laws here? I don't know. I just wonder if
It
that.
would be worth inquiring and finding out about an attorney from an attorney. What will that situation be? Particularly, when you know that the, and I'll just, use the father has the ability to pay. Like he's somebody who works, he's somebody who has a business. Like, I wouldn't send everybody out on those kind of errands and looking, hunting, not knowing. But if they're a business person and employed and, there's a likelihood that they have money, then, I would think it's certainly worth talking to an attorney about, without a doubt, in that country.
I think it is. And in fact, I'm a member of the Association of European Attorneys. I have referrals of really good attorneys worldwide because these issues come up. What if that country outside the United States says, yeah, like in Florida, you know, you can register a foreign court order, right? Like a time sharing or something, and enforce it or even modify, possibly from Virginia or California, let's say. I wonder if countries, other foreign court orders in that country, they allow it to be registered and allow that to be enforced. I don't know. It's worth looking into if clients are running into those problems or issues.
Now let's talk about legal options. Like, what legal options exist if a and I don't know if it matters if they're, you know, I'm going to say a non-citizen parent leaves the U.S. and takes the child with them. So I'll just make it up. I'll say, you know, a French citizen, you know, your husband, or at least the child's father, takes the child and then is there and is like, I'm not bringing him back. Maybe I'll file something here. You know, what are some of the questions that, you know, listeners should be thinking about or that we would ask them? Because I know in the past that's been very scary for the few clients I've had over the years who have said, my husband is a citizen of another country, and that whether it's a valid concern or not, it is a concern for them. You know, and I say, well, you know, if we file for divorce, the court can order that the passports are, you know, secluded. But what if it just happens? You know, they decide I'm tired of living in the U.S. I'm going to go back to my home country and I take the kids with me.
Yeah. And that is a valid concern. If that concern comes up with clients, or potential clients, it's always good to know, okay, what countries are we talking about here?
Yeah, because that's going to make a huge difference, right?
Huge difference, because if it's a Hague Convention, where we have the Hague Abduction Convention, where you can file an application and get assistance from a country partner to assist with that situation by filing a Hague application to get assistance for abduction because the particular parent took the child and over to a Hague Convention country, it's important to know, is it a Hague or not? If the country or countries that we're worried that this parent has threatened to take the child or children to, then we may want language in our court orders, our final judgments of dissolution, to say this child is never to leave the United States to the country of the home country as follows, you know, because the parent has dual citizenship or still a citizen and is not a U.S. citizen or permanent, you know, like you don't have to have that language of the parent status, but to say this child will never be able to be removed and that the Hague Convention would apply, you and language prohibiting maybe a passport is the of getting a passport from that country. Those are things to issues to consider. In those scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, I know. I know for individuals, it's scary because it's like, it's enough, you know, when someone maybe just leaves the state, but you're in the U.S. and then it's just a whole nother, because then there can be language barriers and like custom barrier, like it can be very difficult. All right. Now we've talked about this. Well, we talked a little bit about this when you were on the show before, but I want to kind of talk like, you know, for you to give advice to listeners. So, you know, if you marry someone while you're living overseas or become engaged, should you marry before or after returning to the U.S.? You know what? Because I know it's complicated.
Yeah. Does it
what
matter?
Would you advise if, you know, all our clients asked us this question before taking the action? What would you say?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think individuals, U.S. citizens who want to marry someone who is overseas, you know, you can marry so long outside the United States, so long as it's recognized as a legal valid marriage in that country.
Okay.
One thing to be very mindful of is know the home country of your fiance, okay? And before you marry, make sure that person was legally divorced or annulled before you marry that person.
Mm.
Because not all countries, they have different legal systems, judiciary. They don't, you know, they all have their own systems and laws. And for instance, in the Philippines, they don't do divorce. They only do annulment. So people don't realize like, okay, you married someone, but did that person get the annulment before they married their second spouse? So you can marry so long as the legal valid marriage recognized in that country, and then you have a marriage certificate. And be mindful, you marry someone in another country, they've got their own laws that you have to comply with to have it as a a legal valid marriage in that country. They may need to consult with an attorney in that country to make sure they've done the right paperwork to legally marry over there.
That was really, I didn't think about that. Make sure that they were legally divorced before. I wasn't even thinking that, but clearly that's an issue that you've had before to, or has happened.
Yeah. And I've actually had to divorce people so they could legally marry because they thought they were legally married to their second or third spouse. When we go back to the record, they never actually got a divorce from their first one or an annulment, or they thought it was done in their home country. And then they moved here and they legally did everything, but they never, do you have a copy of the annulment or the divorce decree? And they're like, no. And I'm like, you just trusted your ex that it was done, but you never saw it. Those are issues that have to be addressed. So any U.S. citizen wanting to marry someone in another country, there's some questions you got to ask your fiance.
And we did. And, in order to legally bring your foreign spouse to the U.S., that marriage certificate in and of itself doesn't necessarily get you out of the airport. Right?
No. In fact, a lot of people think I married him. Why can't I just bring with me? And it's a country that doesn't allow where you have to apply for an immigrant, like a non-immigrant visa or immigrant visa, a green card. And they're like, why can't my spouse come with me? It's like, well, because they have to go through a process.
Yeah.
It's one thing to legally marry someone and you have a right to marry who you want. Right. But then the second question becomes the federal immigration question and the process. And that's what it's a really important point to bring up to U.S. citizens to be mindful of that. And even permanent residents, if they obtained their green card through marriage to a U.S. citizen and they got a green card that way and they divorced and they're marrying again, there might be some extra questions. Well, you got your green card through your first one. Now you're applying for citizenship. They may want to ask you about your second marriage, to inquire about that. I'm just, that can be looked at. Some people marry 4 or 5 times. If that person keeps petitioning green card and they're on their third wife or something, they'll probably get flagged by immigration.
I would bet eventually you're gonna get flagged. Yeah, for sure. But I think, and I know we talked about it on the first show, but I think it's really important because we've all watched movies and we, like you said, as U.S. citizens, enjoy a lot of freedom to come and go to various places that you could fall in love and marry, foreign-born individual. They don't automatically get those freedoms. And that's like a real bummer, right? When you're at to the end of the honeymoon and you're headed home and they can't come with you.
Come with you.
And they're like, I'm stuck in the airport, where do I go? What do they do? Is there a detention? Like, are you detained at the airport in the U.S. somehow? Or,
well, if you come in, you don't have the proper legal authorization to enter the United States and you're not from one of those countries that, they allow you to visit without a visa. Yeah, they could, especially now. They could definitely detain you, question you for several hours. What is your purpose? How come you are here without the proper authorization?
Right.
What is your intent? And, and so spouses of U.S. citizens, if they don't have the proper authorization, or even if they are allowed to enter because they're Canadian maybe and they just want to visit, again, it's always discretionary. If that Border Patrol or ICE thinks at the port of entry, like let's say at an airport or train station or bus station, thinks that you are here to violate immigration laws and you are not here for the intent that you're here. Oh, I'm going to visit. I'm just here with my spouse. Like, really? And then the way they answer, maybe they have doubt and they have suspicion. They can say, you're not entering. You're going to have to turn around and take a flight back home. Sorry. Mm. And it actually happened one time. And the answers, I wasn't there. And the client ended up just answering, yeah, I'm planning to stay here. What? I thought you're visiting, so they turned her away and we have to petition for her immigrant visa. But, how you answer, what information you provide, again, don't lie. Tell the truth why you're here in the United States. And if you're not sure about the proper authorization, then ask an attorney before you get on that flight. I've had users this annoying because they kind of came home, but they couldn't bring their new husband or new wife. I have to have that.
Well, and also I can imagine, especially, it's got to be intimidating. And if you haven't pre been, pre if you're not prepared for being questioned as to why you're here, you have no preparation to know what to expect. And even if you are being truthful, you could be really nervous. There could be a language barrier. There's so many things that they have discretion to be like, I don't know if I believe you or not. You're sweating profusely. You must be lying, right? They're just nervous. And I think that's, like you said, like find out, and especially, as US citizens, bringing somebody back, like do your homework. Like, and even if it was like this whirlwind, like surprise, true love
Proposal,
and
like,
marriage, call
yeah.
somebody before you come home. Like, don't put them in that position. That'll put a quick end to that marriage, I imagine.
Yeah, I actually had a. Yeah, there was a case in which the U.S. citizen married this woman, and he didn't realize the process. And once he discovered how much and how long and how expensive, and he decided to just divorce her as soon as she got here legally, but then tried to divorce her immediately when he realized couldn't hack the filing fees just to file with immigration,
Oh
and
my
tried to
gosh.
abandon her, and she was pregnant with their child. And that was a really interesting hearing because,
But,
yeah, and it
yeah.
was like, what is she supposed to do? She doesn't yet have work authorization. She's not allowed to. Oh, and that's another thing. Okay, they go through the legal process and they bring the spouse. Like, why can't she work? Why can't he work? You have to have legal authorization to work in the United States. Just being your spouse doesn't automatically entitle you to those benefits. So you have to wait. You have to wait the process. And so I think they ended up back together, ironically, but a hot mess.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario for sure. But family law always is.
I know, never a dull moment in family law, ever.
Nope, everybody's got so many unique situations. Well, Maria, we've reached the end of our show. Once again, such a pleasure to have you on. You're so knowledgeable, and I really appreciate you answering all my questions, even when I go off on a tangent, because I'm interested in something. But before we go, can you impart on our listeners what you've learned about women and their resilience throughout your career and experience?
Well, just bringing up the last example I was thinking of is, women are tough, but they can also be very forgiving. Things can be thrown at them and they can suffer through what they suffer through, but yet they come out and they do what they think is best for their children. They try to work things out. And I think that's a very admirable trait to have. And I think the women, and I speak to the women too, who feel they may not have the confidence to make decisions. And I think, they should believe in who they are and what's right for them and for their children, and not back down if that's really what they think is best. And given the right attorney and advice also is incredibly helpful. So, like your law firm and all the women you have in your firm, I think it helps the women to understand women and what they're going through.
Well, thank you so much. And lastly, Maria, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
Yeah, so my number is 904-3693, and there's my website, immigrationlawfla.com. They can schedule a consultation, and we also do presentations out in the community as well to groups.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of our show today, and we're so appreciative of Maria Aguila for joining us to discuss how immigration and family law intersect, the legal process and challenges of international adoption, and key protections and considerations for individuals with dual citizenship. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.